This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Welcome to the Trumpet's weekly review of all the important news. I'm Joel Hilliker, and with me is our panel here in the studio. We have Jeremiah Jacques.
Thanks for having me.
And Andrew Miller.
Hello.
From our office in Britain, we have Richard Palmer.
Good afternoon.
And from our office in Jerusalem, Brent Noctegal.
Hi.
Evidence of China's aggressive imperialistic posture on the world stage grows seemingly by the day as it increasingly dominates world trade. It exerts massive political pressure on other nations, squashes free speech and dissent in territories like Hong Kong and Taiwan, extends its military reach in ports and nations on every continent. It's pouring tremendous resources into its military endeavors, including cyber attacks and advanced weaponry. Well, now more and more evidence is emerging of its aggressive nuclear ambitions. For this story, we'll go straight to Jeremiah.
Yes, China is building yet another nuclear silo field, one that is believed to be able to house up to 110 nuclear-capable intercontinental ballistic missiles. So it was only about 4 weeks ago that specialists examining satellite imagery discovered that China was building a huge new nuclear silo field near the northwestern city of Yumen. That one is home to around 120 missile silos. And that was huge news at the time because it showed that China is altering its nuclear posture. And it's moving away from the strategy of minimum deterrent that it pursued for so many decades. Under that strategy, China had only 20 operational silos for liquid fuel intercontinental ballistic missiles. But now, here we are just 4 weeks later, and the Federation of American Scientists has now found a second new nuclear silo field under construction in another part of the country. This one is near the city of Hamai in eastern Xinjiang, actually very close to one of those Chinese concentration camps that we discuss very often. And this latest one, as I mentioned, it's believed to be able to house up to 110 nuclear missiles. So when you add that to the number of silos under construction in Yumen and some other smaller clusters that have been found around the country, the total number you get of nuclear ICBM silos is 250. So for decades, China's had just 20. And now with these two new fields, it'll have more than 12 times that number. So just a massive expansion. And now it is possible that China doesn't plan to have missiles in all of these silos. Nuclear powers have often used many of their silos just as empty decoys, with missiles being routinely rotated around into different silos to keep their opponents unsure of the missiles' exact locations. But even still, this shows that under President Xi Jinping, China is abandoning its minimum deterrent nuclear strategy, and it seems to be in the midst of a massive expansion of Chinese nuclear firepower.
Well, the analysts who are studying this information, the satellite imagery and what China is doing here, talk about what concerns them in the context of, as you said, China expanding its nuclear capabilities in other ways and its general military posture.
Sure, yes. This increase in nuclear silos is not the only development that's going on there. Alongside the silos, the People's Liberation Army Rocket Force also now operates approximately 100 road mobile ICBM launchers. Those are based at more than a dozen different military hubs across the country. And over the last few years, China is believed to have built six of their Type 094 Gen class submarines. So all of those are armed with up to 12 nuclear capable ballistic missiles, which they can, you know, launch from beneath the waves from a wide radius. And then China is also known to be developing a new nuclear capable subsonic strategic stealth bomber. This is the Xi'an H-20, and that one is expected to be able to rival the US's B-2 bomber. And that really completes China's nuclear triad. It means they can fire nuclear weapons from land, sea, and air. And then, as for all the nuclear material that they'll need for these expanding programs, the Chinese have several advanced nuclear power facilities under construction right now, and they have the type of fast breeder reactors that make large amounts of weapons-grade plutonium. The commander of the U.S. Strategic Command, Charles Richard, he spoke about these fast breeder reactors recently, and he said, quote, "That will change the upper bounds of what China could choose to do if they wanted to in terms of further expansion of their nuclear capabilities." So, you know, I think when you put all this together, it really does show that Xi Jinping's ambitions for China include a major expansion of its nuclear weapons program.
Now, we look at the development of a nuclear capability in the world very closely because of biblical prophecies that really point to these weapons being used as part of a massive World War III. This is not the only place in the world today where we see developing nuclear capabilities that point to those prophecies. Maybe you could put what's happening here in China in its larger context, even prophetically.
Sure, yes. As alarming as these, you know, recent developments in China are, it's certainly not the only nation that's making major advancements in its nuclear weapons program. As you said, in recent months, Russia has shown the world that its hypersonic nuclear missiles can now be fired from its warplanes. Then we've got Iran pushing forward in its drive for nuclear weapons. North Korea has recently made some big strides in the delivery systems for its nuclear weapons. Then in Germany, soldiers have been receiving more and more training about how to use the nuclear bombs that America has stocked in Germany. And then there's Pakistan, where more worries are coming up over just how vulnerable its nuclear weapons are to terrorist hijacking, especially since America is now pulling out of neighboring Afghanistan and the Taliban is just quickly taking over parts of the region there. So in so many different places, nuclear developments are occurring that really expose, I think, just how fragile the global peace is. And if you look at Bible prophecy, there are many passages that talk about a war that will soon break out. And Matthew 24 tells us that this future war will be so destructive that it will have the potential to wipe out all human life from the planet. So from that detail, we know that this is talking about a nuclear war. So I think when we see China building so many more nuclear silos and apparently preparing to greatly increase its nuclear arsenal, that shows us just how soon this future war could happen. And it could be easy, I think, to become discouraged about that. But those same prophecies that talk about this coming nuclear war also say that mankind will not be wiped out by that conflict. The war will actually be interrupted by the most exciting and hope-filled event in world history. And Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Gerald Fleury has written a booklet on this subject. It's called Nuclear Armageddon is at the Door. And he explains a lot of what the Bible tells us about this devastating war. But he also discusses that good news about the interruption, that history-altering interruption that will follow it. So I hope that any listeners that don't have a copy of Nuclear Armageddon is at the Door will go to thetrumpet.com and order a free copy there.
All right, well, thank you very much for that, Jeremiah. We, in addition to that booklet, Nuclear Armageddon is at the Door, we also have this article by Jeremiah Jacques, China's new nuclear missile base exposes the fragility of the global peace, where he talks about these latest advancements in China. You can check that out as well. That's on the front page of thetrumpet.com. Angela Merkel is in her final days as Germany's chancellor, so German politics are about to change dramatically. But in some ways, it's already been changing. This is evidenced by a notable shift in Merkel's own position on immigration. For this story, we'll go to Richard Palmer.
That's right. We're in a bit of a deja vu moment here as Europe fears they could face another major influx of refugees. I mean, if you think back, one of the biggest events of the last decade has been the flood of people coming into Europe in 2015. And the German Chancellor Angela Merkel very famously said, "We can do this." That's probably perhaps her most famous speech. It's probably the most controversial decision that she made as a chancellor. Rather than putting up barriers and sending soldiers to guard borders, Germany would welcome the migrants and deal with this influx. We can do this. We can bring them in. We can look after them. This was the message, and I think the message perhaps got a bit rosier than she intended it to. A lot of migrants very quickly took that as a Germany's got the welcome mat out for us, And you had around a million migrants at that time of year arriving in Germany. And like I said, we could be in of a repeat of some of those events. Instead of ISIS taking over Syria, we've got the Taliban now retaking Afghanistan. Germany's Welt asked this week, is another 2015 threatening Europe? We've seen those headlines a few times since 2015, so we'll have to see if that's the case or not. But what we can already see is that Angela Merkel is responding differently. This time she gave a speech, she said, we have already taken in a great many Afghan refugees. She said, we have to approach this differently. We cannot solve all these problems by taking in people. So very clearly a different direction. That is not a we can do this message. It's a we cannot do this. Mm-hmm. We cannot fix this by taking in people.
And just talk about what this says about where Germany is, why she's shifting this position. There's a lot of Germans who have been looking for a tougher posture against immigration for quite some time. Here, this woman who's been famously friendly toward immigrants is shifting. What does that say about where Germany is today?
Yeah, there's a lot of shifting going on in Germany. There was a poll about a year ago, I think it was fascinating, where only 25% of the people in that poll said, I supported Angela Merkel welcoming migrants at the time, and I still support her. And nearly as many people, 17% or 18%, said, well, I did support Angela Merkel in welcoming migrants with the I can do this, but I've changed my mind. Mm-hmm. And I think that poll tells a stark story that there have been a lot of negative repercussions from this. It was perhaps a well-intentioned declaration, but bringing in a million people from the war-torn Middle East has created problems. And the I can do this mentality swept a lot of those problems under the rug. People that brought those problems up were accused of being racist. You had all kinds of stories where you would have migrants committing crimes. You'd have politicians not wanting to talk to them, the mainstream media covering it up. This then ended up, because nobody in the mainstream would talk about it, ended up pushing people to the right, even to the extreme right. You've had the rise of the Alternative for Deutschland, which has leaders that celebrate Germany's Nazi past in some cases, rising to levels of support that would have been unthinkable prior to 2015. It's ushered in a wholesale change in German politics. And now we're facing an election where there is no clear leader. You look at the polls, and the most popular person or the most popular candidate is none of the above. Mm-hmm. You know, you ask people, you give them the top three names, 45% say none of the above, while those leaders have between 15 and 20% support. You have this situation where there's not really a clear path to a strong leader either, because German politics is just fractured. You've had, with the rise of all of these new parties, a massive loss in support for Angela Merkel's party, even a massive loss in support for the main left-wing party. So a whole range of negative consequences from that declaration.
So the Middle East is very dangerous right now. We're actually going to be talking later in the program about just the vacuum that is being created by the United States pulling out of that area. There are a lot of migrants that are searching for homes. Germany is suggesting that maybe Turkey would be a good place for them to go, but Turkey is having problems of its own and having difficulty accepting more migrants. There's a real crisis brewing here. It is interesting that this is happening at the same time that you have this election being readied in Germany. How do you see this playing out, Richard, going forward, and how does Bible prophecy inform what's happening here?
Yeah, I think there's a couple of key prophecies that really just intertwine that you talked about just then. One long-standing prophecy that we've been talking about, you know, that the Bible talks about, is Europe getting more involved in the Middle East. There's a key prophecy in Daniel chapter 11 that is very clearly calls itself an end-time prophecy, and it's a prophecy between the king of the north and the king of the south, and it's a clash between a European power led by Germany and a radical Islamist power led by Iran. And you can read more about that in our booklet, The King of the South. And there's a whole range of other details. The Bible gives us a lot of details about that prophecy, but it's very clear that we're going to have Europe, and we're going to have Germany in particular, get more involved in the Middle East. and be doing a lot more in the Middle East. And you can definitely see how this migrant crisis plays into that. You know, we can't welcome all the migrants here. Like you said, there's people looking to Turkey as a stopgap solution. But basically, that's paying protection money to Turkey. And how long is Europe going to tolerate having someone like Erdogan every time he says jump and Germany's got to turn around and say how high, because they're afraid that Erdogan, if they don't do what he wants, will come in and flood Europe with migrants. That I think people in Germany know that that is not a long-term solution. It could help in the short term, but they don't want to put themselves in that position to be blackmailed. And so, yeah, this is absolutely driving Europe into the Middle East, knowing that when North Africa falls apart, waves of migrants arrive in Italy. When Afghanistan falls apart, waves of migrants arrive in Greece. They've got to deal with these problems. America can pull out and be somewhat insulated, at least in the short term, from some of the fallout. Europe doesn't have that luxury, and so it's driving that prophecy forward. And then we've also got these very clear Bible prophecies that talk about a strong leader coming to Germany. And we have an article in the upcoming Trumpet print, I believe, by Joshua Michels, that just really, it was a really good job of tying together all of these different trends in the run-up to the German election. And this is just one of many things that are causing Germans to want a strong leader, one of many crises that confront the next German leader, that will have to be high on the next German leader's agenda. How do they deal with this? And none of the mainstream leaders and politicians have any great solutions. So this is just another story that is changing German politics and driving them towards a different way of doing politics, ushering in that strong leader who is very different from Angela Merkel that is clearly prophesied in the Bible. And you look at both those trends, and these are critical, important trends in end time events and in God's plan for these events. And you can really see those events coming quite very quickly as you see how this is playing out within Germany.
Well, we have an article up on the website right now by Josue Michels, Angela Merkel, No More Immigrants. And he not only details what is happening with Germany's position on this point, but he points to these prophecies of a prophesied clash between Europe and the Middle East, and even how Germany is preparing for that clash even today. Go check that out at thetrumpet.com. We'll link to that in our show notes. And also, as Richard mentioned, that article from Josue that will be in the coming print edition of The Trumpet. We're sending this to the printer today, or we sent it yesterday. We'll approve pages today. That will go up on the website next week. And it talks about Germany being transformed by crises, such as the immigration crisis that we're discussing today. Thank you very much for that, Richard. Let's go now to the Middle East, where the crises are creating so many of these migrants that are flowing into Europe. The United States is making a hasty retreat from Afghanistan. It's announced plans to exit Iraq by the end of the year. Some fear it's creating a tremendous power vacuum throughout the region. For this story, we'll turn to Brent Noctegal.
There was reporting this past week from the Gulf and also from Israel relating to this pullout of the Middle East by the United States, focusing not just on Afghanistan, not just in Iraq, which we're focused on before, but also the Horn of Africa, Somalia, specifically. And what these articles are noting is that there is a vacuum that's being created by the United States withdrawal. And while the articles don't necessarily say who's going to fill that vacuum, it notes that these are ongoing conflict zones, each one of them where radical Islamists are a part of the fighting force that the United States is fighting against. So if you're talking about Afghanistan, of course, it's the Taliban that is wanting to reinstate its rule over the country. Afghanistan right now is a very dangerous place to live in. I've just been looking at some maps from the past 6 months to show the gains of the Taliban in terms of territory that it holds now over the Afghani government. And right now the Taliban holds more territory than any time since 2001. And the United States is evacuating over 20,000 Afghanis out of Afghanistan to the United States and elsewhere. 200 of them arrived. The first batch arrived in the United States today. Just because they know that Afghanistan is going to be run by the Taliban very soon, and anyone that had any type of working relationship with the United States, they're going to be targeted by the Taliban. And so the U.S. is trying to find homes for 25,000 people. So the Taliban is going to take over Afghanistan. There's no doubt about that. And we've reported on Iraq and how the United States has really showed its hand, that its desire is to leave. And then Somalia, there used to be a mission of the United States in Somalia. This started, the withdrawal there actually started by President Trump, and it continued now under Biden, so that the Al-Shabaab, the terrorist group there that has ties with Al-Qaeda and also Iran, they are fighting back to take over that territory. And so in each of these, if you get a map out and you just look at these, this swath of territory from Pakistan all the way through to the African Sahel, just and including Somalia, Ethiopia, to the Mozambique, there's all these very volatile situations. The United States has announced it's gone and it's going, and the radicals are gobbling up the territory.
Well, yeah, that's a very important point that you mentioned just right there at the end. If the United States vacates and leaves a vacuum, what fills the vacuum? And it seems like virtually every situation that you just described, every nation where the United States is withdrawing its presence, is being filled by radicals, and in many cases, they're driven by Iran.
Yeah, if you're talking about obviously Iraq, Iran is a major player, and also in Somalia, Al-Shabaab is an Iranian ally, although it's a Sunni organization. But even the Taliban, and the Taliban was in Iran 2 weeks ago discussing how it's going to go forward inside once it takes over the country. And the Taliban now controls many of the border crossings in Afghanistan, making it a key revenue source for the Taliban, getting more money as well. And so you are looking at a dangerous situation. Remember, the purpose of going into Afghanistan was to knock out the Taliban because it supported Al-Qaeda. It gave safe haven to Islamist extremists that would then target the United States, target Western interests. And so why, of course, there is plenty of reasons for the United States to look at its work over the past 20 years in the Middle East and throw their hands up in the air and say, it's time to go, we haven't done much. But then you have to really ask the question, what happens next? And the hastiness of the withdrawal is what people are really worried about. I mean, to announce that you're leaving Afghanistan and give a deadline no matter what, to announce that you're leaving Iraq and give a deadline no matter what, that emboldens adversaries to know that all they have to do, they can pick up increase their attacks, and the United States is not going to do anything. Now, something that these articles bring out is the U.S. has increased airstrikes over the past week in Afghanistan, in Somalia. But as we've known for a long time, airstrikes aren't an effective countermeasure against the Taliban or others. They're a face-saving technique of the United States administration to show we are doing something, but that isn't going to hold back the radical Islamists in these areas. And there are areas where Islamists aren't like adjacent to these places. If you're talking about even some parts of Iraq and some parts of Syria and even Ethiopia, which borders Somalia and Eritrea as well, there might not be Islamists involved in the fighting yet there, but those countries are extremely destabilized right now, fighting their own civil wars. And so you can really see how United States' absence from some of these countries can spill over to radical Islamist gains into nations where, let's say, the United States does not have an active presence right now.
What we're seeing is really exactly what the Trumpet has been saying, and our editor-in-chief has been saying from the earliest days when the United States increased its presence in the Middle East after 9/11. This is some 20 years ago. Talk about the prophecy that we're seeing unfold here.
Right, and so Mr. Flory has talked about how, even as Richard mentioned, that there is going to be a radical Islamist camp that reigns supreme over much of the Middle East directly prior to the Great Tribulation. And this is a force with a pushy foreign policy that is going to control critical maritime choke points through the region. It's also going to really pose a big threat, as Richard said, for Europe, based on the geography of the nations it's going to control. This prophecy is found in Daniel 11 and verse 40 to the end of the chapter, basically. And it talks about how the territory, basically from Iran or Iraq, all the way through to Libya, modern-day Libya, and perhaps even into Tunisia, which just experienced a coup this week as well. So that country is destabilized right now. This whole swath of territory is going to belong to this radical Islamist camp. And it was hard to see how this would happen while the United States maintains a strong presence, while the United States maintains its allies, supports, let's say, strong men that keep debt back and tamp down on the Islamist elements of their society. But now the Joe Biden administration is announced to the world that it seeks to vacate these areas at the precise time that the radical Islamist elements are surging forth in power. And so we really need to look for these prophecies as going ahead fast. That's what we're watching for. We're watching for radical Islamist and Iranian elements to make the most of the U.S. withdrawal, because that is what will directly precipitate that push, as Richard was talking about, against Europe, mentioned in Daniel 11, verse 40. If people want to understand more of this prophecy, please read the King of the South booklet.
All right. Thank you very much, Brent. This week in Washington, Congress staged its January 6th commission, supposedly aimed at getting to the bottom of what they call the most dangerous attack in American democracy in the nation's history. Wasn't really truth that they were seeking. To learn about this, we'll turn to Andrew Miller.
Yeah, Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi has put together a bipartisan commission of Democrats and Republicans who chose to impeach Donald Trump. There weren't a lot of options on the Republican side, but they found two that they could get on this commission so that they could let everyone know that they're lest anyone accuse them of being one-sided, that there are actually members of both parties on the commission. And this Tuesday they heard testimony from four very carefully screened Capitol Police officers about what happened on January 6th. And there was definitely a lot of emotion to it, a lot of tears, a lot of anger, stories recounting about like racist abuse that they endured on this horrible day. But interestingly, it's their focus on what needs to be done was very zeroed in, as you'd expect with such a carefully screened group of people, on investigating Donald Trump's role in inciting the Capitol invasion. One of the officers, he slammed his fist on the table and said that nothing has prepared me to address those elected members of our government who continue to deny the events of that day, and in doing so, betrayed their office. And he even went on to compare President Trump, like a hitman hired by somebody, I guess, to stir up these riots. And then another one of the officers had a quote that was pretty interesting as well, where he's saying that as patrol officers, we can only deal with crimes that happened on the streets, with misdemeanors and occasionally violent felonies. But you guys in Congress are the only ones who've got to deal with the crimes that occur above us. I need you guys to address anyone in power who had a role in this. If anyone in power coordinated or aided or abetted or trying to downplay or tried to and prevent the investigation of this terrorist attack, because we can't do it, we're not allowed to. And now that, actually, that second statement is kind of insightful in a way, and the fact that, like I said, that we do need a deep investigation as to what happened above the police level, because the police can only deal with the crimes on the streets. But interestingly, it's not really President Trump that needs the deep investigation. I mean, we have a pretty clear role of his role in this whole thing. We have his tweets telling people that he wanted them to come to this protest to protest election theft. And we have video of his speech telling people to go home as soon as things got out of hand. And that's pretty much seems to be the be-all and end-all of what President Trump played in this. But there is very concerning allegations about the FBI's involvement.
Right.
I mean, you've got several militia. They've arrested 540 people already, but there's like several known right-wing militia group members who stirred up violence on the day who have not been arrested, despite knowing who they are. And like I said, the only explanations that's been put forward for that is, well, those are the ones that were FBI informants. And so in terms of what that officer said about, like, we need a congressional investigation into the crimes that happened above us, it's like, technically is a correct statement. We do need a congressional investigation into the role the FBI played in deliberately inciting this Capitol breach to discredit President Trump. We probably don't need much more investigation into, like, President Trump himself in that, like I said, yeah, we have the video of his speech telling everyone to go home, so.
Yeah. Yeah, we talked about this on Wednesday's program with that plot to kidnap Governor Whitmer that showed that the FBI was actually inciting a lot of this. And Stephen Fleury has been talking about this on the Trumpet Daily Show as well, the fact that that the FBI is going beyond its normal purview of just trying to keep an eye on what is happening. They're actually at the center of this, and video has emerged of FBI agents there at the Capitol on January 6th, actively encouraging people to breach the Capitol, to enter the Capitol. There is a lot of concerning information here. What we've seen on Capitol Hill is just 100% political theater, and the people who are testifying, and some of these, there was one individual in particular who, he's been at Black Lives Matter protests, he's been actively encouraging Black Lives Matter, and he's the one who's just so alarmed at what took place on January 6th and making these allegations about racist remarks that he had to endure and so on. It's just hard to take any of this seriously.
Right, and I think, I mean, even some, like, kind of liberal news sources are pointing out here that Pelosi may have kind of hurt her political career to an extent doing this, because, like, even the, you don't have to be a diehard Republican to see that a bipartisan commission of Democrats and Republicans who chose to preach Donald Trump isn't a setup and not a legitimate investigation trying to get to the role of, like, who incited this violence, what role did Antifa play, what role did militias play, what role did the FBI play. And yeah, our executive editor, Mr. Stephen Fleury, has been covering this from pretty early on. I mean, he has a Trumpet brief from January 26th, only about 3 weeks after the January 6th Capitol breach, titled America's Reichstag Fire, even kind of comparing this event to the Reichstag fire in Germany in 1933, where in order to take power, like I said, Hitler staged, staged a fire and then used it to claim that enemies were attacking Germany, so they had to give more power over to him, which is kind of what they've done here. I mean, you've got the FBI inciting people, and we've got the video of FBI inciting people to breach the Capitol, and then the Democrats using the fact that the Capitol was breached to claim that Donald Trump was trying to take over the government, therefore he needs to be kicked off social media, and we need widespread censorship, and we need a commission to hunt down people who claim election fraud, and really using, like, authoritarian police state tactics to clamp down on anyone who claims Joe Biden's an illegitimate president, and trying to get people on side with this because of the fact that you're blaming President Trump for a Capitol breach that the Democrats and the FBI probably orchestrated.
Yeah. Remarkable to see this taking place in America's Capitol. Where would you send people for more information? You mentioned how much Stephen Fleury has been talking about this in recent months on the Trumpet Daily. Anything that people could go to read?
Yeah, the cover story of our March 21 edition of the Philadelphia Trumpet is the President of the United States asterisk And it's got a subhead in there about the Reichstag fire angle we just talked about. But it's also got a much more sweeping overview of everything from the ballot stuffing in the before the November 3rd election to the inauguration of Joe Biden, just showing, well, not all the fraud, but a lot of the fraud and a lot of the underhanded authoritarian techniques that were used to install Joe Biden as an illegitimate president, and then putting it in context of the prophecy in 2 Kings 14 about this really like satanic effort to blot out the name of end time Israel. And so, so yeah, we'll definitely put that in the show notes for anyone who wants more information about where January 6th fits in this whole puzzle.
All right. Well, thank you very much for that, Andrew. You're listening to Trumpet Hour. Coming up, the EU undertaking an alarming level of surveillance over all financial transactions. Russia deploying warplanes to the border of Afghanistan to address instability following America's withdrawal, and more. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Trumpet Hour, the Week in Review.
Last week, the European Commission announced a plan to increase its supervision over financial transactions in order to combat money laundering. But the effects of this ruling go far beyond just that. For this story, we'll go back to Richard Palmer.
Yes, they unveiled a new plan to limit cash payments and to restrict cryptocurrencies on July 20th. And like you said, the excuses always for these revolve around money laundering, stopping bad people being able to spend their cash. And they're planning to set up a new anti-money laundering body by 2024. There's kind of this whole general war on cash throughout Europe, even throughout the world, where they want to establish a limit of, it works out in dollars at about $11,800 on cash payments, so that you can't, it's just illegal to conduct transactions with large amounts of cash. In 2019, the European Central Bank stopped printing 500 euro notes. So that's another, designed to make cash payments harder, more cumbersome. And they're also talking about introducing their own digital currency. These are called central bank digital currencies. You've probably heard of Bitcoin, unless you've been living under a rock for the last few years. This is something that has become massive, and this is something that is seen as a key plank of anti-money laundering and just general government control, because a push towards central bank digital currencies establishes a massive level of control, an unheard of level of control over nations' economies and individual spending. Because if you think about a digital currency, a virtual coin, well, the key problem there is, how do you make sure you don't spend the same money twice? With a physical note, I can't give you a $100 bill and then turn around and give someone else the same $100 bill. Once I've given away that note, I don't own it anymore. But if it's digital, if that money is just a string of letters and numbers, I can give that string of letters and numbers out to as many people as I like. So the solution to this problem of how do you stop digital money being spent multiple times is to keep a record, a ledger, as they call it, of every single transaction. So if I offer you one Bitcoin, you can look at that ledger and check that I didn't give that same Bitcoin to someone else 10 minutes earlier. So if you have a central bank digital currency, you have a central bank and really a government that sees every single transaction, mm-hmm. that has a record of every single transaction. So the EU is currently working on their own central bank digital currency, and they're not the only one. In 2021, BIS, Bank of International Settlements study, just recently found that 86% of central banks are looking at setting up their own digital currency. So this is something that could very soon become a big deal worldwide.
So critics who are looking at this say this gives government officials a tremendous amount of of understanding of what's happening with their citizens that they're very uncomfortable with, that this gives them power over general transactions among citizenry. And for those who are students of Bible prophecy, looking at this being discussed on this level in European countries really gives us pause. Explain
yes,
why.
Yes, and it's not just critics that are saying this gives the government unprecedented powers. Its supporters are kind of boasting about the same thing. In October last year, the International Monetary Fund hosted a discussion on these central bank digital currencies, and the general manager for the Bank of International Settlement, Augustin Cartens, he was speaking, and he said, well, we don't know who's using a $100 bill today, and we don't know who's using a 1,000 peso bill today. The key difference with central bank digital currency is the central bank will have absolute control on the rules and regulations that will determine the use of that expression of central bank liability, and they'll have the technology to enforce that. Absolute control of technology. FX Street wrote an article on that just a few weeks ago, saying digital money gives bureaucrats the power to monitor and control the spending of everyone who adopts it. And they talked about how officials could limit, they could put certain geographical boundaries, for example. You can only spend this money within this area, or if you break the rules, you lose your money, these kind of things. And this does tie absolutely into Bible prophecy. You know, we talk so often on this show about a key prophecy in Revelation chapter 17 that describes this conglomeration of 10 nations that's ruled over by a woman. In Bible symbolism, that's a church. So you have this group of nations ruled by a church, and this chapter describes it rising and falling. It's talking about the Holy Roman Empire in Europe, and that's the only place where you have this pattern of rising and falling and this empire led by a church. You turn the page and you get into Revelation chapter 18, and you're immediately talking about merchants and trade. It's very clear that there is a strong financial component to this power. And then you have incredible these specific prophecies. You go over to Revelation 13, a clear parallel scripture that talks about this empire having a mark that no one can buy or sell without. And it's controlling the economy of its individuals. You know, whether or not it ultimately ends up using a central bank digital currency, it's very clear that it wants and it desires a absolute control over the economy of its citizens. And that's what we see building in Europe today. We can see it building towards that kind of superpower that the Bible forecasts. And we have an article on our website that talks more about that, abolish cash, establish absolute control. And then we have our free book. If you want to know more about those prophecies I just went through rather quickly, our free booklet, Who or What is the Prophetic Beast?
All right. Thank you very much for that, Richard. We spoke earlier about the instability seizing Afghanistan as the United States pulls out of that country. Well, Russia is taking steps that can easily be seen as positioning itself to deal with this instability. For this, we'll go back to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, it was yesterday that Russia's Central Military District reported that they've deployed a group of their Su-25 attack aircraft to Tajikistan, so that they can take part in some military drills that Russia, Tajikistan, and Uzbekistan will be holding near the border with Afghanistan. So, as you said, Afghanistan is rapidly falling under Taliban control, and this is a cause of real concern for Russia, because so much of Central Asia was part of the Soviet Union, and Russia still views that as being within its sphere of influence. So they don't want the region to be destabilized by rampant terrorism, especially since one of Russia's most important military bases abroad is in neighboring Tajikistan. And so that's a big part of what these war games are all about. The games are to take place from August 5th to the 10th. There will be about 1,500 soldiers altogether. And the addition of this group of Su-25 warplanes really elevates the profile of these military exercises. These Su-25 jets are designed to provide close air support for ground forces. They were instrumental in Russia's victory over Georgia back in 2008. They've also played a big role in Russia's operations in Syria over the last several years. And they are precisely what Russia would need to help defend its military base in Tajikistan if the Taliban began to threaten the security of that base.
Now, China and Russia both have talked about Afghanistan, or looking at what's happening in Afghanistan, are very concerned about that. Talk to us about what steps they're taking, generally speaking.
Yes, sure. This week, the defense ministers from the Shanghai Cooperation Organization got together, and they discussed the Afghanistan situation. So the Shanghai Cooperation Organization is a security group that's led by China and Russia. It also includes Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan, Tajikistan, and Uzbekistan, as well as India and Pakistan. So, you know, just a vast grouping of nations that represent about one half of the world's total population. And they got together and they just discussed how the Taliban's takeover there in Afghanistan is affecting other parts of Central Asia. And these nations, China especially, as you said, they're just determined to coordinate their strategies and to work together to address these challenges. So the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, it's already grown into an extremely important international Asian group. But with this critical new mission now taking shape there in Central Asia, I think we can expect Russia and China and all these other countries to draw even closer and to learn to depend on each other even more.
But it is interesting that that's taking place in the absence of the United States, that you can see the power shifting to these Asian states. If you want more information about this, you can read our booklet, Russia and China in Prophecy, to see the long-term prognosis for that region of the world. Thank you very much for that, Jeremiah. This week, there was a deadly attack on an oil tanker off the coast of Oman in the Arabian Sea. To learn about the significance of this event, we'll turn to Brent McDougall.
Yeah, this is still a kind of a breaking story as we're recording this program on Friday afternoon, local time here in the Middle East. And it involves an attack that took place last night, Thursday night, on an Israeli-managed ship about 300 kilometers off the coast of Muscat, the capital of Oman. So this is just after you exit the Strait of Hormuz and you're going out to sea. This vessel didn't have any cargo on board. It was coming from Tanzania, if you're Richard, on the way to the UAE. And it looks like it was attacked by an Iranian drone, killing the captain. This is all kind of breaking and yet to be highly confirmed. Israeli sources are saying on TV that the captain was killed, as well as a security guard. The company of the security guard has confirmed the death of one of their agents on the ship. And one of them was a Romanian that was killed, and also a United Kingdom citizen, and a British citizen. And so while the details of this attack are still coming in, it is significant that you have deaths taking place in this attack. Normally, there has been a series of attacks, probably three or four in the past 3 or 4 months, against Israeli-managed or Israeli-owned shipping commercial vessels through this area, particularly close to the Gulf of Oman on the outside of the Strait of Hormuz. And Israel, of course, has said that Iran was behind these attacks. But the use of a drone in this attack is, I think, significant. And it kind of elevates this shadow war that people are talking about that's happening at sea between the Iranians and the Israelis. In this case, two innocent people were killed. And there was the U.S. Navy and the British Navy, they're discussing another incident that took place around the same time as well, close to this, but they haven't allowed details to come out about it. And so this is a significant, I would say, increase in the level of sophistication of the attacks so far out at sea by the Iranians. And it basically is a sign to the Israelis that if you have commercial interests anywhere near us, especially involving shipping, naval assets, then you are a target for our weapons.
Can you put this in the larger context of efforts to revive the Iran nuclear deal and the change in government in Israel? How do you see this, the timing of this event in light of those?
That's a good question. I would say the Israeli government is still going to try and be as strong as it can against the Iranians. It is a losing political scenario for any Israeli government to allow Iran to get away with such an attack. However, there will be a lot of pressure on the Israelis from the Biden administration to not attack Iran too strongly right now, given that they are embroiled in these continuing nuclear talks. However, I would draw attention to the fact that the Obama administration really did is very let's say they're very aware of this Iran's desire to hit at Israeli vessels, and they even, going back now 3 months, leaked a story to the Wall Street Journal about Israeli attacks on Iranian vessels as a way to try and give the Iranians cover for the forthcoming attacks that we've seen, to show that this is kind of the Israelis attack the Iranians attack the Israelis, and this is just the way it is. There's not one aggressor and one defender. They're both belligerent as each other. And so I think that this is what we're seeing right now. You will read reporting of this incident, and in the end, at the end of every one of those articles, it will talk about the Wall Street Journal article. It'll talk about how Israel has been attacking Iranian vessels. They might not mention the fact that Israel is upholding UN-backed sanctions on these Iranian vessels that have weapons on them, or they're selling oil to Syria or something like that. But they're justifying the Iranian attacks on commercial vessels, on civilians that happen to be affiliated with Israel. And so Israel will defend itself, I guess, in these situations. However, I think the larger point is Iran is showing that its reach to really under threat, not just Israeli shipping, but international shipping, extends on out now. Last week we talked about how they took over, or they have a terminal now outside the Strait of Hormuz, meaning that they could shut the Strait of Hormuz and still get their oil out to sea. So what are they going to do now? They're going to push their abilities out further from the Strait of Hormuz, all around the Saudi Arabian Peninsula, the Arabian Peninsula, to show that that is their domain, that is their arena. And this is going to increase costs that might make it prohibitive on Israeli commercial interests through here because of the insurance costs and things like that that come with it. And so I think what we're seeing here is Iran extending the reach of its power outside of its typical area or domain in the Persian Gulf, out into the Indian Ocean, specifically against Israelis. But again, there are other commercial vessels that would be taking note, and nations that would be taking note of this as well.
Well, thank you for that. If you would like more information about that, we will link to an article in the show notes from Brent from a few years back, Iran's Strategy to Sabotage World Trade. We appreciate your bringing that to us, Brent. We'll keep our eyes on that situation. We'll finish with a story about the U.S. government indirectly censoring Americans by pressuring big tech companies to do just that. One senator is trying to combat this unconstitutional practice. For this, we'll turn to Andrew Miller.
Yeah, one of the effects of the January 6th Capitol breach we talked about in the first half of the show was that the Obamas sent a letter to many of the Silicon Valley big tech companies, basically instructing them to censor President Trump from their platforms, an order that the big tech companies obeyed. And in the months since then, there's been many other revelations, probably the most recent coming from the Biden White House, saying that they've also instructed the big tech companies to censor COVID misinformation, an order they have also obeyed. And so many people are growing concerned about this. So Senator Marco Rubio from Florida has introduced legislation on Wednesday to combat this censorship, basically by proposing a law that would force the big tech companies to publicly admit every time they get an order to censor information from someone in the U.S. government or from a foreign government. If the bill passes, they'd actually have like 7 days after someone in a government position told them censor this to make that public so that the American people can see what they're being told to censor, which I don't know what the chances of the bill passing are, but it would definitely be a good bill because we've got an article we can put in the show notes that I wrote this week on The Rise of Digital Fascism, which talks about like the investigative journalist Glenn Greenwald bringing up the point that like this defense that the big tech that Democrats use to say that like, okay, well, it's not a violation of the First Amendment for big tech companies to censor because they're not government, they're private companies. But he said, but if the government's, Glenn Greenwald saying that if the government's doing this on the order, if the big tech companies are doing this on the order of the government, then they are almost like an arm of the government.
Right.
In fact, that's actually even the classic dictionary definition of fascism is the merger of state and corporate power, or when a privately owned monopoly takes orders from the government. So a big serious threat, and an ironic one too, in the fact that like the order to censor Donald Trump was like, oh, we need to stop these fascists from who invaded the White House by having our big tech monopolies integrate themselves into a government power structure. We'll definitely put that in the show notes. It definitely factors into that verse we talked about in the first half of that show in 2 Kings 14 about just blotting out the name of Israel, because this big tech censorship and this January 16th commission, I mean, it's all part of one bigger story being directed by Democrats and the government.
The Rise of Digital Fascism. Go check that out at thetrumpet.com, and you can also find that in the show notes for today's program. Thank you very much for that, Andrew. I'm Joel Hilliker, and that's it for today's Trumpet Hour. Email us your thoughts on the program to letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to our panel, Jeremiah Jacques, Andrew Miller, Richard Palmer, and Brent Nachtigall. Thanks to Parker Campbell for engineering and production. I'll leave you with the words of Ralph Waldo Emerson: beware what you set your heart upon, for it surely shall be yours. Thanks for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
Listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.